Class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother Ryan Mendez. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. I happen to be watching this amazing YouTube channel. And I mean absolutely amazing YouTube channel. I've been on YouTube since 2007. That means I've probably watched a couple thousand or several thousand channels in the interim. This channel is easily a top five or a top three channel. That's how good it is. I've been binge watching the channel for much of the past week. The channel is titled Renegade Cut. Renegade Cut. R-E-N-E-G-A-D-E space C-U-T, Renegade Cut. And I happen to be watching this video titled Late Stage Disney. I'm not going to talk about the actual argument that he made, because the argument was really great, and truthfully, he did himself a disservice by only having the video be like 22 minutes. For the type of argument that he was making, he needed probably 45 minutes. And there are several of his videos where I have found that to be the case, that he makes arguments in 22, 23, 24 minutes, which he really needs if he's going to solidify the audience. He needs 40 to 50 minutes to make. Sometimes, you know, as I keep telling brothers and sisters that I'm talking to online, and particularly on YouTube, sometimes the idea that you should cut off a video just because you think it's going to be too long and people's attention span may not last, please stop that. They'll come back to it. It's more important to lay out your idea, and if it takes 45 minutes, if it takes 55 minutes or 2 hours, and you can actually see the substance in everything that you've put in there, some people just like to blabber on and on and on, then, yo, do it. In fact, I think that's one of the biggest problems, and sorry to get into this tangent, but seriously, I think that's one of the biggest problems with progressives and leftists presently, and why conservatives are eating your lunch. Whereas you think time is a metric when you're trying to explain to somebody something. You think time is a metric which should be shortened. Conservatives don't care. They put out stuff all the time that is 2 and 3 hours long. To you and I, we sit there and we go, ugh. But to a conservative, they sit there and go, yes, 3 hours worth of stuff that I can eat. More of you need to start thinking that way. Now, I'm not talking about, again, just rambling on and on and on and on. No, like when you watch Renegade Cut, what you'll see is he fills every single moment with substance. Not just stuff, substance. And that's important. And as a person who's been doing a podcast for a long time, I can tell you, there's times when I just ramble on and on and on, and I have not published episodes because I re-listened to it and said, I can't even listen to it, so how am I going to expect people to listen to that? Blah. So substance, important. That stated, at the end of that video, he played a clip from the from a Democratic primary debate where Christian Gillibrand was saying that there's a big difference between capitalism and greed. Now, ladies and gentlemen, some of you may recall years ago, I made a statement that I really, really was a huge fan of Chris Hedges, and I still am a huge fan of Chris Hedges. He is one of the most brilliant people that is on the scene today. But I said then that I completely disagreed with his statement that the type of economic system that we were witnessing at the time, back then he was maybe a little naive, where he kept saying, this isn't capitalism. And I kept saying, no, this is capitalism. You're just seeing it for the first time. This is capitalism. And here I want to make the same statement about Ms. Gillibrand. And I know it's old now, but I think this is an argument that people are having a lot more and more and more. And it needs to be argued, or this point anyway, needs to be argued. People say constantly, oh, well, there is a difference between capitalism and greed, or this type of capitalism and that type of capitalism. And what I always tell people is the same thing. You judge the fruit of a, you judge the tree by the fruit that it bears. You judge even the seed by the fruit that it bears. People who say that, you know, there's a difference between capitalism and greed are lying to themselves. They're lying to themselves. Either that or they're trying to lie to the public. Because if you look at the systems that preceded capitalism, if you look at the systems that preceded capitalism, there's no way that you could be surprised that capitalism is acting the way that it's acting right now. Capitalism has always been reckless. It has always acted in the benefit of a very small group of people. Capitalism is, by its very definition and nature, anti-democratic. It has always been against democracy. And it has always had a complete ambivalence and a disdain and almost a hatred towards nature. The early seeds of capitalism, which we could look at the colonies, when the first colonies were up and running well for Europeans, not Native Americans or soon to be Africans. One of the primary things that, and here I'm not even going to, well, I could go into the Caribbean, but I'm going to just stick to the United States mainland here. One of the primary things, or two of the primary things, that the people who were settling in the colonies bothered to center their economic hopes on wasn't gold, wasn't silver, wasn't precious metals. It was timber, and it was furs. They literally went to work cutting down massive amounts of trees just to be able to ship them back to Europe and killing everything in sight just so they can create furs mainly for the upper class. I mean, some of that trickled down, absolutely. But mainly for the upper class. By this time, they had already organized, through devastating means, the Caribbean. And they already had plantations and were growing tons of stuff down there, which they could then send back to Europe. And particularly the elite. This is the beginning of capitalism. Oh, well, that was under a different system. It all contributed. If you want to talk about capitalism in the mid-1800s or in Europe in the late 1700s, early 1800s, then you cannot erase imperialism and colonialism and the things that they did at the beginning, because it was only through setting up those quote-unquote markets the way that they did, which was in a way... It was psychopathic what they did. It was brutish what they did. But it was all in the name of riches and money and wealth. They would kill tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, all in the name of market wealth. Yes, you didn't call it capitalism then. You didn't come up with that name until the 1700s. But the reason why you could have capitalism in the late 1700s, early 1800s, was because of all of that wealth that was being generated by the structures that had been put in place in the 1600s, the 1500s, and the slave trade, which was just a free labor source. You could have capitalism with people making more money than they knew what to do with. People making, by the beginning of the 1800s, you had people making so much money, which compared to now isn't anything, but you could measure dynasties who thought they were wealthy prior to them and didn't have any kind of money compared to these people. Especially by the late 1800s and how America took over capitalism. If you are going to stand there and tell me that there's a difference between capitalism and greed, then you have to explain to me the robber barons. Those people thought they were capitalists. They would have slapped you in the face because you're a woman and they didn't, you know, respect women. But they would have slapped you in the face and told you, you ain't smart enough to walk in my shoes. Call me and tell me I'm not a capitalist. I'm a capitalist. You may think that that's wrong, but that's who these people were. You know, I ain't into changing history just to make you feel good. But these people knew they were capitalists, and they would have fought you to the death if you try to claim that they weren't. They were capitalists, and greed was a part of capitalism. It is only as we have finally, as a society, realized the danger of capitalism, which happened in the 1930s, and we started to curb that greed by putting limitations on it, were we able to get a hold of capitalism. Capitalism was always capitalism. And in fact, what is increasingly now becoming revealed through various books and people who like to dive or spend time diving in archives, is that the whole reason why those tools which we used to get a hold of capitalism were rolled back was because people were really angry that they couldn't exercise their greed incentive anymore. Recall what was said in the movie Wall Street. Greed, for the lack of a better word, is good. And that's capitalism. That is the... When we literally look at the United States of America, the United States, absolutely, I agree with most conservatives when they say America has always been a capitalist country. They're correct. The problem is they never finish that sentence and ask the logical question. What kind of society has that made us into? See, it's easy to be a conservative when you don't have to think. But conservatism isn't about not thinking. A conservative has the hardest job in the country. Oh, wait. Did you hear what I just said? A conservative has the hardest job in the country. Why? Because a conservative, in their traditionalist way, must be able to see what values the country upheld at the beginning of its inception, and then send them through a process of delineation and purification to understand how those principles should be interpreted today in a way that furthers the agenda or the vision which those principles originally started off trying to project. So when we talk about liberty, conservatives should have been the abolitionists. And in fact, I would probably argue that conservatives were the abolitionists. The people who were against the abolitionists, who were for enslavement, they weren't conservatives. I actually haven't figured out what to call them. But they weren't conservatives because they weren't adhering to that original principle which the United States supposedly was built upon. No, they kept saying, well, you know, we were built upon the idea that Negroes weren't supposed to be our equal. Well, if you take away the whole liberty concept, then yes. If you take away the whole freedom concept, then yes. All of those things, by the way, can be interpreted one way for economic purposes. But it's when you get into the justice, then you have to reconcile yourself with what those things really mean. And even for economics, what does it really mean in the economic realm for you to achieve justice? It's a compounding concept when we look at the preamble of the United States Constitution, which doesn't go far enough, if I may say, but it's what it is. The country is indeed a capitalist country. It has always been a capitalist country. But what kind of society has that made us? Are we willing to even entertain asking the question? Because people have asked the question. And to be honest with you, and to be fair, other people have not liked the answer that has come out of that question. But it's a fair question. There's a book that I found some time ago called No Contest, The Case Against Competition by Elfie Kahn. I love that name, Elfie Kahn, A-L-F-I-E-K-O-H-N. Like most of the books that I own, it is not a new book. And I would suggest that you read it. This book was written in the 80s. I have a lot of books from the 80s and the 70s. I suggest you read it, and I suggest you read it because it takes on all of the narratives that we have become accustomed to. No Contest by Elfie Kahn. A-L-F-I-E-K-O-H-N. That's his name. No Contest is his book. It takes on all of the arguments that we have heard throughout the last 30 years supporting this idea of hyper-competitiveness in this country. It's something, it gives you something to think about. There's another book that is called Dismantling America. And if I could see it, then I would absolutely tell you who it was by, but I cannot see it right now. It is a book which the great Ralph Nader actually is blurbed on. It's an older book. It's a book from, I believe, the 70s, the late 70s, when when deregulation was just starting to crank up. And the book is called Dismantling America, The Rush to Dismantling America, The Rush to Deregulate by Susan J. Tolkien, T-O-L-C-H, T-O-L-K-I-N, and Martin Tolkien. Husband and wife team, by the way. T-O-L-C-H-I-N, Dismantling America. This is another book. Gives you some food for thought, guys. It's an older book. Might be the beginning of the 80s. 1983, so I apologize. It wasn't the end of the 70s. But I want to read to you what Ralph Nader blurbed, or was blurbed on the back of the book, what he said about it. Dismantling America is an engrossing probe of the ways corporate power has assaulted the laws which would restrain business abuses of consumers and communities, bringing nonpartisan insights and judgment that won't always satisfy either business lobbies or consumer groups. The Tolkiens provide a solid affirmation of the historic and continuing need for humane laws to be applied on the inhumane corporate impact in the marketplace. That's from one Ralph Nader. Check out the book. I mean, it'll give you food for thought. We are living in an age where capitalism is coming to an end. COVID-19 is telling us that capitalism is going to come to an end. We are now being challenged with bringing the world together, and truthfully becoming interested in the betterment of all of humanity and the planet. The Hopi talk about the three great shakings of the world. And the fear that I have is that we are really barreling towards the third great shaking. The first great shaking, which came during World War I, was again meant to get us to start getting our house in order and start coming together as one. Obviously, that didn't really take. So the second great shaking happened, and that was worse than the first one. Each time for those two great shakings, it said that the Father, the Creator, took his hand, one hand, and shook the planet for each of them. Now think about the devastation that was caused in World War I, and then think about the devastation that was caused in World War II. It was said during the second great shaking that something called the gourd of ashes would be dropped. That was the atomic bomb. Well, if we didn't shape up, there would be a third great shaking, which, if I recall the mythology correctly, they said that the Father would take both, or the Creator would take both of his hands and shake the planet. And we would see the gourd of ashes be dropped on them who dropped it in the first place. Karma. Karma, karma, karma. Now, history is not certain. The Hopi made it sure that we understood this. And they said we could stop these things from occurring. Or at least try to lessen the impact of the third great shaking. Ladies and gentlemen, we are in a period of time where we are being activated. All of this that you see happening right now. COVID-19 appearing. We were told about this disease appearing on landscape, you know, at the end of last year. They didn't take it seriously because they were too busy playing their reindeer games. The fact that George Floyd lost his life and you saw the anger that came from that. wasn't by accident. His little girl said it. Her daddy's gonna change the world. I had a thought about that, by the way. A powerful thought. When he saw his mother, what that meant, what that signaled. Many of us, particularly in the black community, we forget what the old mama used to mean to us. She was a representation of the goddess. But beyond that, we're about to see something even more drastic happen. It is likely that by the beginning of August, you will see millions, possibly even upwards to several tens of millions of people enter the process for eviction and into the process for losing their homes. It's so funny because I remember Jimmy Dore talking about how Barack Obama kicked 5 million people out their homes. And yeah, I remember that. And I don't mean to beat up Jimmy Dore about this. That's not what this is. But here's what's crazy about it. Is some of the same people who were around back then and did nothing about it are still around now, and Obama's nowhere to be seen. These people kicked 5 million people out their homes, and they're about to kick a whole lot more out their homes now. And not even bat an eye. This country has a choice to make. And I'm going to tell you right now, we all have to make it. We have a group of people who are stuck in mythology and trying to pretend that the world isn't the world that we're living in, and that the United States hasn't played the role that it's played in the last 200 years. But now we have to make another choice. There's a group of us that we see the reality. We see the reality. And we are trying to get America before it is too late to see the reality, because we cross that line, you will know it. You will know it not simply by an election, but you will know it by a mushroom cloud. That's what you will know it by. The people who are stoking the hatred, the fear, the divisiveness, they think they're safe. They think they are safe. They got their beautiful homes. They got their platinum-style healthcare systems, including private hospitals and doctors. They think they are safe. Mother Nature says you are not. Tom Hanks did indeed survive. He did. There will be a reckoning. There will be. All of these people who don't want to help the ordinary American, the ordinary citizen, all of these wealthy people, including Mr. Elon Musk, who wants to put profit before health, there will be a reckoning. I guarantee it. Not because I'm hoping for it. No, because I smell it in the air. I smell it. Before I leave, let me give you a clue of what I'm talking about. Mother Nature is not dead. Oftentimes when I say that, I think most of you underestimate what I'm saying. Mother Nature is a living organism. This earth is a living organism. Through its grace and through its beauty, she projects life so we can live here. If she so wants, she will cease that projection and we will no longer live here. The advanced temperatures that you are witnessing, that's a fever. That is a fever. Hear me, that's a fever. What then are these viruses that we are suddenly witnessing? We had 3 pandemic-style viruses in the first 10 years of this century. We technically, if I've seen the numbers correctly, I think we had 3 counting COVID-19. The second decade of this century. This one is obviously the most serious out of the 6. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a defense system working. Now, those of you who think, oh, well, this is just man-made, and this is man-made, and this is man-made. Let me give you another way of looking at it, because, okay, well, fine, I'll give it to you. Maybe this is man-made. Fine, it's man-made. It is crushing the economy. Do you really think wealthy people would do that? Because right now, they can depend on the stock market to buoy their prices or their wealth. But the problem with the stock market is, after a while, those prices have to start catching up with the on-ground scenario. So even if they had assumed that this virus would take 6-7 months and then it would go away, the economic damage is far worse than even they could have projected. Even they're shaking in their boots. This isn't man-made. This is something man can't create and something that man cannot control. This is Mother Nature fighting back. This is her throwing a pitch towards your head and telling you, if you don't shape up, I've got worse. I've got worse. I saw an article where they listed or talked about several hundred potential coronaviruses that are known to exist in pigs and bats and some other animals that could possibly jump to the human species. And I laughed. Because I'm like, these are known coronaviruses that you obviously have studied. Yet you didn't know about this one. So if there are several hundred that you know that could do devastating things to humanity, what don't you know about that Mother Nature is hiding from you? This is her last warning. This heat that we're feeling, her last warning. Get your house together before the Great Mother steps over everybody and unleashes the dogs of war. Which then, see, we've had the father overseeing us for a long time, but now the mother's coming back. And she's sick of playing games with her children. The dogs of war that she'll unleash, there'll be nothing like you've ever seen before. And there will be nobody safe. And that's something that the Hopi talked about. This land was protected during World War I and World War II. This land. Not this time. Get your house in order and stop this madness. Because if it comes down to her If it comes down to her having to get our house in order for us, there ain't nowhere that you can hide. Nowhere.
Let me go ahead and take a break here. I will be back on the other side.
Just begun.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, so I am back. I'm back. So I am watching Status Quo and realizing what he is saying is very correct about the cliff that this country is heading towards. In about 9 days, I am recalling arguments I used to make in the early days of this podcast when I would speak about the thinking process behind what the elites did, particularly after the 60s. An argument that I was keen on making was that the wealthy looked at the 60s and attributed the rise in democratic, hate that word, but democratic action to the free time that people had been given via basically the gains by the unions during and after the Great Depression period. They then set themselves towards rolling back the leisure time people had and the ability that people had to not only spend time with their families, but to spend time with their friends. I used to make that argument a lot. As I have watched the frantic, absolutely frantic manner in which the wealthy have tried to start sports again in this country, I have been reminded of this argument. Why? Because the wealthy aren't stupid. The wealthy aren't stupid, and I need to really underline that. They know that the reason why there hasn't been much protests about anything they've done in the last, let's say, 30 years, and by much protest, I mean there has been protests and there has been significant protests, but there hasn't been sustained national protest outside of Occupy Wall Street, and they crushed that. But one of the reasons why this occurred, and they knew this, was two reasons. One, people had sports to watch. The circus was in town. The ceremonies were happening. So people had nothing else, well, nothing better. They did have better things that they could do. But because people were working so much, and they were tired when they got home. I mean, when you're working, and I mean working 40 hours, 50 hours, 60 hours a week, when you get home, you're not thinking about going out and protesting. You're not thinking about going online and getting your news fix. You're thinking about leisure time, relaxation, trying to put in time with family, trying to put in time with friends. So sports was a logical way of doing this. The second way was movies and TV. Movies and TV. Now, obviously, television-wise, they've had to roll back, and movie-wise, they've had to roll back scheduling new episodes, or new episodes of, you know, long-running shows and what have you. But that's less consequential than the sports. Why? Because with sports, people got out the house. People could put their passion somewhere else. I mean, literally, especially when you're talking about football, people literally identified their fanship with belonging to a nation. And I mean, I've had conversations with people where I'd have to calm them down and go, look, guys, sports is something fun to talk about for me, but I'm not into it like I'm ready to bash your head because you don't see the way see things the way that I do. There's more important things than that. People literally were committing their lives to sports teams. And to show you that wealthy people knew this, I was listening to a black commentator. I won't say who, because he's kind of a conservative black commentator, but he's a black commentator who does a lot of work for the black community in his conservatism, and I respect him enough, except for some of the conservative things that he has to say. He said something, which many of you might say he said the quiet part out loud, but he said something that I heard repeated by white conservatives prior to him saying it. That if there had been NBA basketball, black people especially, you got to pay attention to this. If there had been NBA basketball, the protests over Michael Brown's, Freudian slip, the protests over George Floyd's death would have been minimal. If there had been NBA basketball, not if there were movies, if there had been NBA basketball, the protests would have been minimal. Moreover, if people weren't home because of the coronavirus, the protests would have been even more minimal. Ladies and gentlemen, these people have developed a system which keeps your ability to protest at a minimal. I've told you that before. I mentioned it a long time ago. I used to talk about it almost every episode, and I stopped. But they have now admitted it. And they're not lying. It's the truth. I ask you, we live in the year 2020. Production is through the roof. Why are we working 40-hour weeks? We should be working 30 or less, and because of how much productivity is garnered off of our work, we should be making between, even at $30 an hour, you should be making $25 to $30 an hour. Now, obviously, people are going to say, small business, small business, small business. Yeah, let's be very frank about this, okay? Small businesses do not set the tone for anything in this country. Okay? They don't. And furthermore, from the taxes that should be raked in every single year from the production of this economy, this economic system, and even without taxes, I guess you can still do this, but you can subsidize small businesses to make sure that small businesses don't have a problem paying those levels. We can do it, and we should be doing it. Modern monetary theory, which I guess I'm going to be diving into a lot more in the next couple of years, points us the way towards doing that. And we really need to be thinking more and more about that. This is, though, something that is a fact now. The way that we live is over. It's done. And I really look at COVID-19 as that. As a line in the sand by the cosmos saying, from this moment onward, the way you've been doing things ain't working. It ain't going to happen anymore. And if you continue to do it, there will be more hell to pay. I believe that's the case. The question is, will we learn? I want to talk with you today about I want to talk about a couple of things, but I want to start here. What COVID-19 has really unveiled about this country. because it has unveiled quite a bit. Obviously, COVID-19 has shown the difference between the United States and what is often called the European Union. When you do not have a strong safety, a social safety net, when you do not have a government that is responsive to the needs of the people and not just to the wealthiest, you get this. You get this nightmare scenario. When politicians are more interested in competition and deception, especially for the public's consumption. For the competition, I'm looking at Andrew Cuomo, who, if he had listened and not had such a vendetta against de Blasio from New York City, and he had listened to de Blasio when he wanted to shut down New York City, New York City might have not became the hotspot that it became. When your governing strategy mirrors that of Republican Rome, this is the nightmare that you get. I often have to stop myself from constantly referring to the United States as the reincarnated remnants of feudal Europe, because I truthfully see it that way. Every bad idea that Europe was like, you know something, let's get rid of that. America was like, you know, that seems like a great idea. Let's put it into place here. And you're seeing the results of it. Whereas European countries had no problem stepping in and saying, yeah, we're doing this for the common good, for the commonwealth, for the social good. We're going to help everybody during this pandemic because we are one country. We are one nation. The United States said, oh yeah, we have no problem helping corporations. To all you little people, we're going to kind of, sort of, maybe, possibly give you a little bit of something. But, you know, we are one corporation, $100, individual, with liberty and justice for none of you people. Back up. All you peasants, back up. Stop it. Come on. You don't need much. It couldn't be more stark. I mean, it's funny that people aren't trying to, and maybe, I don't mean this the way that it's going to come out, but maybe it's a good thing that they haven't made this connection. But it's kind of funny that people aren't trying to accuse Bernie Sanders of, you know, somehow getting in bed with George Soros and making this happen to prove himself right. Because every single thing that he was arguing for literally 12 months ago, ladies and gentlemen, has proven to be necessary. Has proven to be necessary a year later. And yet we get sleepy Joe Biden. And he might win. Maybe he'll be better than Trump. But this thing, it has revealed the need for a robust, though independent and insulated, kind of like the USPS is, national healthcare system. I don't care anymore about the feelings of wealthy people or why big business might not be for it. I don't care about those people anymore. I don't. Because especially for wealthy people, they're not caring about healthcare right now. They have their own healthcare. They don't care. And for big businesses, most of them don't care. They've made record profits over the last 10 years. And that was until there was the fight for 15, none of that was really going to the average worker. The argument is now sound for a robust national healthcare system that is insulated, like the USPS. And yet, I'll tell you why these people may ultimately run from universal healthcare. One, because they have, over the last 30 years, and I can remember when this really kicked up during the, about 93, 94-ish, I was about to say middle of the 90s, but they have successfully privatized most of your hospital chains. And the problems that you're seeing in the hospitals today come from the fact that they've been privatized, that they're not community-based. I often think also, how much does privatization play into this whole racial health gap? I often think about that. Because corporations see black bodies as dollar signs. And if they have to actually spend money on the black body, you know, that eats into their profit. There's a thinking process that goes, every corporation has a spirit. And sooner or later, working there, you will gain that spirit, or you will become a part of that spirit, and you will start acting involuntarily with that spirit. So people can tell me how good folks are and what have you, but if the spirit is the spirit, nah, you can't fight it always. That's just a fact. But outside of that, and I want to really, really impress this part onto you, when it comes to healthcare, one of the reasons also why I think these people don't want to do universal healthcare is, one, they'd have to then start to invest in black communities. And they don't want to do that. Because let's be very frank, ladies and gentlemen, black communities are segregated. We tend to live in places that white people don't. And if you are going to build hospitals that we are going to have primary access to, you're going to have to build them in our community. That means you're going to have to train staff in our community, and you're going to have to build up our community a little bit more. And I think these people don't want to do that. There is a caste element to that. Because you can keep telling white people that all their problems belong, you know, to those Negroes over there in that community. But apart from that, and kind of apart to it, is this: if they were to actually give healthcare impacts every single thing else. Because then you'd actually start seeing, and you already see this somewhat, but most of us don't have access to it, but if you have a structure which is committed to communal healthcare, everything that they find out in pursuit of healthcare, of maximizing healthcare, of making healthcare better, that's going to be disseminated broadly in that community. What am I talking about here? They're going to start actually telling you the consequences, the physical, psychological, and emotional consequences of this culture and of this economy. They're going to be able to tell you, and you will not be able to hide from the fact that this culture and this economy is a stressor that causes tons of diseases. Because then you're going to have to start dealing with why the economy and this culture is such a stressor, and how you can then move forward by reforming the economy to make sure that it doesn't stress people out so dang much. Which would probably include something crazy right now something crazy right now as giving people 4 weeks of vacation. Paid vacation. Ladies and gentlemen, you do not realize how much healthcare dictates so much of our lives. Then you'd actually have to change the nutritional habits of this country, which would stem all the way through, or flow all the way through the elementary schools, the high schools, and back to the farmers, and thus you would have to change the agriculture business, and particularly the agriculture corporations, which, ladies and gentlemen, you know how much they're looking forward to doing that. This is why they don't want to touch healthcare. Because healthcare would reveal the emptiness of their system. And by revealing the emptiness, it would mandate that we fix it. Chris Hedges often talks about the state of children and people and the Virginia Hills. Most of us don't have any clue about that. But if you have a national healthcare system that is insulated, well, it's likely that Virginians are going to start seeing the devastating consequences health-wise of mountaintop removal, and you'll probably think that Virginians will say, whoa, 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 we ain't know this was going to happen. Forget that. We ain't doing this anymore. Stop it. This is deep, ladies and gentlemen. This is why they don't want to touch healthcare and make it a national priority and make it a national instrument. Because, see, then you shift your intelligence capacity. And when I say intelligence here, I do mean your information gathering techniques from one of repression and suppression to one of healing. This is also why I suspect after World War II, the Wall Street apparatus that became the CIA was so willing to fund the CIA and thus fund the military and intelligence industrial complex because they wanted control over the country. Let's be very frank about it. And corporations cannot have that control if they do not have a method of surveillance. Now, obviously, there are some things with healthcare that one might say, well, you know, it could be used in a wrong way or it could be used in an incorrect way, things like that. That's what I mean by insulating it. That's what I mean by insulating it. You could and should develop a system that is similar to the USPS, which is completely funded by the government, similar to the Pentagon, where its structure is completely separated from the government. There should be, obviously, civilian oversight. Not sure exactly how that would work. We'd probably have to look into Canada and the United Kingdom and probably Australia to answer that question. But there would have to be strict follow the letter of the law regulations that stop people from utilizing the healthcare system in a way that could be negative to other people. But we first have to even come to the conclusion that we need it. The fact that Joe Biden said, I will veto Medicare for All if it hits my desk, is arrogant. What he essentially has said is, if the people pressure the House of Representatives, who then puts pressure onto the Senate, to pass a law that the people want, universal health care, I, because the wealthy are paying me and want me to do it, just like Trump, Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, don't ever fool yourself. The wealthy like Trump, and they love having Trump in office. Stop this nonsense that they don't, because they do. But I will flaunt the will of the people because I know better than them. That's arrogant. Mainly because the way that things are going, if he pulled that, I'm confident the House of Representatives switchboard would be blown up to the point where his veto will go down in flames, which would absolutely neuter him. He'd have no say, no power, except, oh, that actually sounds like a good idea. Let's play that game. Let's do that. Let's get that done by about March of next year. Come on, let's do that. Let's play that game. I like that game. Neutering the president to the point where basically the House of Representatives can walk up to his door and say, sign this, Mr. President. And he just says, you know, that's a good thing to do. And just signs it. Get it done with. Oh, ladies and gentlemen. These are just some crazy times. Questions, comments, concerns, leave them below. I'm your brother, Vahmir Deese. I'll talk to you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.